Right, our topic for tonight is Yitzhak Rabin's first term as Prime Minister, 1974 to 1977, and the focus tonight will be on his long-standing feud with Shimon Peres, and how that colored almost everything he did as Prime Minister. History regards Yitzhak Rabin as having been a hero of Israel, but a very weak Prime Minister, and whose first administration in the 70s was rife with internal dissent, and that he didn't have a firm grasp over his own government and over policy on the ground all across the country. So this machlokus of Rabin versus Peres, I want to examine that through the prism of three different aspects of policy in the 1970s. One was relations with the United States over the peace process. Two, the Entebbe raid. And three, settlement policy in the territories. So, first thing of relations with the United States. Throughout 1974, Rabin was under a lot of pressure to move the ball forward on the peace process with the Arab states and with the Palestinians. On the Egyptian front, there had been Sinai 1, which was signed while Golda was still prime minister. There was a disengagement of forces after the war. But that wasn't good enough. There needs to be another deal and a further Israeli pullback. But how far? The Americans wanted as much as possible. They wanted a conciliatory Israel. Rabin's point of view was that he didn't want to give up too much in an interim agreement, which was only a step along the way to a major final status agreement of real normalization and peaceful relations with Egypt. So he's willing to go 15 miles, 20 miles, but he doesn't want to go past the passes in the western Sinai, Mitlan Gidi passes. So the Ford administration regards Rabin as a bit of an obstacle to peace, that he is not being forthcoming about what Israel could or couldn't do in terms of relinquishing of territory, and something needs to be done to rouse the Israelis out of their stupor and get them to do more, give up more to the Egyptians.
Was Kissinger pushing this equation?
Yes, but it wasn't just Kissinger, it was the whole administration.
Who was the president?
Ford? So Ford, because while Nixon was still president up until August 9th of 74, the pressure was minimal to non-existent. In fact, Nixon went to Israel in June of 74 to get away from Washington, to get away from all the Watergate crises, and they loved him there. He got a hero's welcome in Israel in June of 74. It was a great visit, and he remembered it fondly. He loved Israel, though, and Israel loved him back.
Some of his best friends.
You should know that Henry Kissinger was invited to Saudi Arabia, and the king welcomed him and said, "I welcome you not as a Jew, but as a human being who happens to be the Secretary of State of the United States of America." And Henry Kissinger's response was, "Some of my best friends are human." Yeah. Yeah, yeah. He uses bad expressions. He didn't like American Jews. He liked Israeli Jews. There's a chiluk between one and the other. Okay. All right. So this pressure on Israel to give up further territory to the Egyptians eventually works, and the Ford administration is able to get Israel to withdraw to the eastern side of the passes. And on September 1st, 1975, the deal is signed, Sinai 2. But along the way, Shimon Peres came up with various ideas. Peres often came up with wild and crazy ideas that you could dismiss. But some of his wild and crazy ideas were downright dangerous. So one of his suggestions before Rabin agreed to move further east and to sign the deal was to have American and Soviet forces patrol the passes with Egypt on the western side and Israel on the eastern side. And Rabin said, "What are you, crazy to introduce Soviet forces in the Middle East willingly?" So this was obviously a policy that was ignored, or a suggestion that was ignored. But it's an example of Peres operating independently, hoping to come up with the solution to the problem, and not waiting for Rabin to come up with the critical solution. Rabin was angry with Peres for leaking to the press. And in one incident, Peres had a breakfast meeting at a Jerusalem hotel with Moshe Dayan. and somebody by accident left a critical document, a very sensitive document, under the table after the breakfast was over, and a hotel waiter noticed it and took it to the Shin Bet, and it became clear that that Peres and Dayan, old buddies, were conspiring against Rabin, and he didn't like that.
Was it an accident?
It was probably an accident. These things happen. So, but the relations with the United States were strained yet improving, and after the Sinai Agreement was signed, and there was no progress on the central front with the Jordanians or the Palestinians, the flow of arms could now commence in earnest from the Americans to the Israelis, and this was a good thing. But there's a shopping list. Israel wants certain items, military hardware, and the shopping list that Rabin brought with him to his visit to Washington in January of 1976 was regarded as exorbitant, or including things that were unnecessary, that more than just critically vitally needed supplies, but sort of pie-in-the-sky, Star Wars-type stuff was on the shopping list. And at a press conference at the Blair House on January 29th, 1976, Rabin complained in front of a hot mic, in front of the media, that Peres was sabotaging his trip to Washington by inflating the shopping list. To which Peres responded, "But you, Rabin, yourself approved of it 3 months ago. So what are you doing blaming me, claiming I'm inflating this list as defense minister? You signed off on every piece of paper." And it was true, he had. So sometimes Rabin opened up his mouth and said nasty things about Peres that were unwarranted.
What about the times he said things that were warranted?
Oh, we're going to see. We're going to see that does happen. Okay. That does happen. As part of Rabin's way of shtuching Peres and pushing him to the side, he hired Ariel Sharon as a military advisor. Ariel Sharon, of course, was the founder of the Likud, was elected to the Knesset, resigned his Knesset seat very early in the term in 1974, and then, just to show that he's not relying upon Shimon Peres, the defense minister, for defense-related and security-related advice, and for that matter, not even relying upon Mata Gur, the chief of staff, he brings on Ariel Sharon as a private prime ministerial defense advisor. This only lasted for a few months, but it was enough to get the message across that Rabin wanted to be his own man and not rely upon Peres or the others. Okay. So, the relationship with the United States did improve throughout the course of 1976, so much so that even though there had been problems with President Ford, including Ford's reassessment, a famous word, reassessment of American policy towards Israel, where AIPAC stepped in and got 76 U.S. senators to sign a petition saying that there should not be a reassessment, that we should maintain strong ties with Israel, and this was a bipartisan effort. So despite all of that having happened only a year earlier, Rabin did what he did in 1972. He openly supported a candidate for the American presidency. Now, that's not something that a foreign leader is typically supposed to do. In 72, Rabin was the ambassador to the United States, and he supported Nixon over McGovern. Why? Well, even though most American Jews were supporting McGovern, from an Israeli point of view, he thought that Nixon was a reliable ally, a superpower ally who could be counted on in the clutch. And in the 1973 war, that turned out to be very much the case. In 1976, it's now Ford versus Carter. You could argue, well, he should support Carter, because after all, the Jews are all Democrats, and Ford had his reassessment of relations with Israel and was coercing Israel to withdraw from the Sinai more than he wanted to, and there were very tense moments. But no, he supported Ford over Carter. Why? He was an Avi. All right, so it turns out that there was a bad incident with Carter when he made a trip to Israel in 73. Carter, while Golda was prime minister, and Carter was just the governor of Georgia, but had ideas about running for the presidency, and the Israelis knew that he had ideas about running for the presidency eventually, they gave him the VIP treatment. Sure. Just like Ariel Sharon gave George Bush the VIP treatment years ago. Okay, so Carter tells Golda Meir when the trip is about to conclude, "Aren't you worried that the Bible says that if the Jews don't keep the commandments, that you'll be kicked out of your land, and most of Israel is secular? To which she responded, don't worry, we have the Orthodox for that. But, now, forget Golda's hysterical response. The point is, what is Carter doing as an American politician quoting the Bible and saying the Jews aren't frum enough and therefore Israel is going to be destroyed? All right, so he's a Bible-believing Christian, granted, but you don't do that while meeting the Israeli prime minister. It's unseemly. Okay, all right, so with that in mind, and... Okay, so Rabin supported Ford over Carter, and it was known, and when Carter won, that made relations between Carter and Rabin very tense, and Rabin made a trip to the White House late in his term in the March of 77, just before things got bad for Rabin with the bank account, and it was a very bad trip. Very, very bad trip, because Carter got the impression that Rabin was inflexible, that what he had given up in the Sinai Two Accords in 75 was about all he was going to give up, and there would be no progress on the Palestinian front. Basically, the peace process was at a standstill. Now, that really wasn't the case. It's just that Rabin didn't tell the whole truth to Carter. In fact, all throughout Rabin's first term, there were contacts with the PLO. Now, this is not for public consumption at the time, but Uri Avneri and other members of the radical camp in Israel, members of Knesset, but at the far extreme of the Zionist or Jewish camp, were given permission, not as Knesset members, but as private citizens, to maintain contacts with elements within the PLO, so that word got back from Arafat. And Rabin liked this because it was a nice secret back channel. Nothing came of it in the 1970s. Something would come of it in the 1990s, when the back channel would be some professors who go off to Scandinavia and cut deals with Arafat and Abu Mazen. But even in the 1970s, this sort of thing was happening with tacit permission of Rabin to his leftist friends, as he referred to them. But he didn't tell that to Carter. So Carter assumed that just Rabin is one of these right-wingers who's not going to give up an inch. All right. Now let's go to... No, didn't know about that, no. It was not something American intelligence would even be looking for. So, let's now go to...
Yeah. Even dare to support one president over another. That's not exactly done. I mean, sure.
It was done. Okay, let's go to Entebbe. Let's discuss Entebbe. So, on June 27, 1976, the plane is hijacked. And the plane eventually makes its way to Uganda after a stopover in North Africa. So, the question is whether or not an attempt should be made to rescue the hostages or to negotiate with the terrorists. At first, the thinking was, well, Israel doesn't negotiate with terrorists. That's not really true, but... That's the formal policy. Israel doesn't negotiate with terrorists. So the cabinet right away unanimously determined that they would pin responsibility on France for resolving this crisis, because it's a French plane, French carrier. It's a national carrier, Air France. And that there will be an attempt at negotiations to release the hostages while efforts are made to contemplate a military option. But no known military option existed on June 27th, 28th, 29th, or 30th. They're first thinking about it, and maybe something might come about.
Did anybody ever consider that France's track record with the Israelis wasn't exactly sterling? How could they really rely?
Well, they weren't. It was clear that France was not going to get the job done, and that the release of prisoners was not going to be something Israel alone could do, because the demands that were being made were for the release of prisoners in five different countries. It wasn't just Israel. It was European countries, I think even in Canada. These were Palestinian and other terrorists who had been jailed. So Peres says, we have to rescue our people. We can't give in to the terrorists. We have to rescue our people. And Rabin says, you're just full of demagoguery. There is no way to do it. We're going to have to negotiate. We're going to have to hope for the best that the release of some prisoners will result in the release of some of the hostages. But don't give us these speeches about Sionut, about Zionism, and about not caving in under pressure. We face a very tough reality. Stop it with the demagoguery. Then, what happened at the cabinet, not at the cabinet meeting, but at a meeting of leading members of the Knesset, including members of the opposition, because after all, this was no longer an issue of government versus opposition. This is a national crisis. So the leader of the opposition, Menachem Begin, is invited to participate in these discussions. And Begin says, I agree with Rabin. We have to negotiate with the terrorists. And that, yes, and that took the wind out of Shimon Peres's sails. The demagoguery had to be cooled off. If even Menachem Begin says we negotiate with the terrorists for the release of prisoners, then cut it out, Shimon.
But Idi Amin Dada was also an actor here.
Okay, so it's interesting. Israel didn't know how Idi Amin was involved in all this. There was a question, what is his role in all this? On the one hand, he had formerly had very good relations with Israel. Israelis had trained his forces, had built his airport.
They
trained him personally, yeah. So there was a colonel, Baruch Barlev, who was a personal friend of his, not Chaim Barlev, the chief of staff, but Baruch Barlev, who was on the phone with him periodically throughout this crisis, doing the government's bidding, telling him certain things that didn't always make much sense, but that's what the government wanted him to say. And the question was whether or not Ugandan forces would respond to an Israeli raid or not. Ultimately, they really didn't. Those who were on the ground in the airport, they fired at the planes, but that's about it. There wasn't like a massive wave of Ugandan soldiers descending upon the airport. He was not at all.
There's a movie that's playing right now.
Yeah.
There's a movie, uh-huh. 7 days in the Dead.
Uh-huh.
And they show the Idi Amin playing both parts of being nice to
him. Right, so he comes in and says, Shalom, Shalom to the hostages, Shalom. He was nuts. He was nuts. Okay, so.
He suffered from tertiary syphilis.
And a few other things too, I'm sure. Okay, so. Rabin was not opposed to a rescue operation. He was opposed to a rescue operation that didn't have a chance to succeed. That was his viewpoint. And how did he define success? So he defined success not merely of taking over the airport and having the hostages under IDF control on the ground, but rather having everyone brought home. Because there was some thought of conquering the airport or the city of Entebbe, but staying there, holding them for a while until some sort of diplomatic arrangement is reached. And Rabin said, that's not a good idea. Very bad idea. If we're going to go, we have to go and leave and get everybody out. Okay, another thing was, what's the casualty rate going to be? So Rabin was not willing to sign off on a casualty rate that was astronomical, but he was willing to sign off on a rate that was between 15 and 20 dead. And ultimately, the plan that was put into effect was assumed to yield a casualty rate of 15 to 20 dead. In fact, how many were there?
Two.
Well, one soldier, three hostages, and one was killed in the hospital, so five.
That 20 number was hostages and soldiers?
Yes, okay. Yes. Now, other factors to be determined was what to do about the crew, and for that matter, what to do about non-Israelis who may have been part of this group somehow. Because there were Jews who were, they were non-Israeli Jews, and there were also a few others who might not even be Jewish at all, but who were assumed to be Jewish by the hijackers and were kept behind. So it was, the government decided that everyone who was there, including the crew, will be treated like Israeli citizens in all respects and will be brought home, and you'll figure out what to do with them after the fact once they're safely on the ground in Israel.
So the crew did stay with them.
Yes, 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 absolutely.
They refused to
go to leave. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So there was insufficient intelligence for Rabin to issue the go-ahead order, even once Peres's people came up with a plan. There were several plans. One was to conquer all of Uganda, which was rejected. One was to conquer all of Entebbe, which was rejected, and the other was to conquer the airport and leave, and that was accepted. But even that was not signed off on by the government until there was sufficient intelligence, which happened by chance, that there was a retired French colonel who was taken hostage and was released when all the Gentiles were released, and he went and was briefing the Mossad upon his return to Paris. This is what I saw. These are the number of hijackers. These are the Palestinians. These are the Germans. And that information was good enough, together with the blueprints of the airport, which was built by an Israeli company, that Rabin was comfortable enough, we could do this. We'll do it. But the government did not make a decision until July 3rd, and after the planes were already in the air. So the planes had to leave from an Air Force base in southern Israel, fly to Sharm el-Sheikh, and then from Sharm el-Sheikh go down the Red Sea over Lake Victoria to Entebbe. And the decision was reached within about 10 minutes to go before the planes would have had to turn around, because there was like a no-go, beyond, you know, no point of no return. That you couldn't turn around at that point and go back. Who took credit for this big success? Everyone wanted to take credit for this success. So Rabin said that if it, the night before the operation, if it fails, I will resign. He also said, if it fails, I'll be hung from a lamppost tomorrow morning. And if it's a success, I'll win re-election. So he knew there was a lot riding on it, a lot riding on it. But others took a lot of credit. And Peres, to the media, the next day, made a statement of, well, this was all my idea, and Rabin was very reluctant to accept it, and only with great hesitation did he agree to my idea. So Rabin wanted to fire Peres on the spot, but was convinced not to do so by the higher-ranking people of the Labour Party, saying you'll precipitate a party crisis, which will lead to a government crisis, which could lead to the collapse of your regime at its best moment, and you wouldn't want to do that. So he didn't. He just called Shimon and asked him to apologize.
Did he?
No. Now, in 1979, Rabin wrote a memoir, which is infamous in Israeli political history as being like the nastiest memoir ever written, by a disgruntled ex-prime minister who was ousted from office over his wife's bank account scandal. So he's bitter over what he saw was the end of his political career, just as it was really getting started. And in that 79 memoir, he claimed he took full credit for Entebbe and said that Peres did nothing but give demagogic speeches. Several members of what had been the 1976 cabinet then wrote letters to the editor of various newspapers saying, this is completely untrue, this is sour grapes by Rabin. Peres really did play a significant role, and that it was Rabin who was hesitant, and they all deserve a little bit of credit, but to say that Peres was just a demagogue is completely unfair and a misrepresentation of history. Okay, yeah. Now, let's discuss settlement in the territories, which is the most juicy topic for tonight. Settlement in the territories. Gush Emunim. What is Gush Emunim? The block of the faithful. So, it's very important to understand that the block of the faithful, as a religious Zionist movement, did not get itself off the ground in the aftermath of the Six-Day War, but rather in the aftermath of the Yom Kippur War. So it wasn't the euphoria of victory that led to Gush Emunim, but rather it was the agony of a perceived defeat, but which Gush Emunim did not regard as a defeat. Rather, they said the general public, the labor Zionist general secular public, regarded the Yom Kippur War as a defeat, but in fact it was a major victory, objectively on military grounds. Yes, there were major casualties, but we conquered territory and we survived, and the other side got bludgeoned. So don't have the malaise of the mid-1970s, but rather be strong. Chazak, chazak, v'nit chazek. And what shall we do? Settle the land. Settle the land of Israel. And not just the easy parts of the land of Israel, but even the difficult parts of Eretz Yisrael. So let's now examine, let's carve up the map. The Alon plan, which was the labor plan set for settlement, suggested that there be Jews placed where in the territories? So, along the Jordan River, where else?
Gush.
On the Golan Heights.
Yeah.
The Etzion block, south of Yerushalayim. The Jerusalem corridor, just north of Yerushalayim. No. Careful.
A ring around.
Okay, so Greater Jerusalem, including the Gush Etzion, the Jordan Valley, parts of the Golan Heights, and northern Sinai, the Raphia Plain. Okay, the area of Yamit. But what is off limits in the Labor Zionist plan? Most of the West Bank, meaning Samaria, the highlands of Samaria, the area near the Green Line, and the area near Hebron, basically the core, the Arab core of Judea. So the Judea, most of the Sumerian highlands, and the area near the Green Line. Why is that off limits? Because in some future peace agreement, that will be given back to the Arabs. Since it's heavily concentrated with Arabs, don't put Jews there. It will be damaging to the interests of a diplomatic solution to the Middle East conflict. Okay, so where does Gush Emunim want to go? Precisely where Labor says you shouldn't go. That means they want to put Jews basically in the Shomron, in the southern Shomron, and in the northern Shomron. The two places that are of greatest significance for our purposes tonight are what becomes Ofra, which was then known as Baal Chatzor, which is not far from Ramallah, and Sebastia, which eventually becomes Elon Moreh, or Kidumim, depending upon which version of it you're talking about. So, in 1974, with Shimon Peres as defense minister, the government is very much divided between hawks and doves. The doves, Yigal Alon and Yitzhak Rabin, and to other ministers in government who are of lesser significance now, they want to follow the Alon plan. And wherever the government doesn't authorize settlement, they don't want Jews going there like in a wildcat fashion, just plopping themselves down and saying, we're here and we're going to stay here. They want it to be by the book, legal. Now, the international community will say it's all illegal, but at least the Israeli government wants it to be legal within Israeli parameters. But Peres, like his buddy Dayan, favors settlement even in densely populated Arab areas, the highlands of Judea and Samaria. And so he's willing to provide support for illegality. Now, Alon accused Shimon Peres of being a Trojan horse for the Gush Emunim inside the Israeli government. Was it true? Basically, yes. So, Baal Chatzor had a military encampment there, and some civilians decided to live there, 25-30 civilians. Eventually, they make a home for themselves, and it becomes the settlement of Ofra. It takes a year and a half to become legalized, but it becomes legalized. Big controversy, and the official government position was against it. They didn't want it to exist, but it's blossoming. In the northern West Bank, in Sebastia, there were several attempts to create Elon Moreh, which is another name for Shechem. So it's right near Nablus. It's an old train station near Nablus, from a defunct railroad from the Ottoman period. Okay, so hundreds of people show up, they get kicked out. Show up again, get kicked out. Many times, get kicked out. Then, November 1975. What happens in November 1975? What important thing in the history of the Jewish people happens in November of 1975? November 10th, 1975. The 37th anniversary of something else that happened on November 10th. Kristallnacht. What happens on the 37th anniversary of Kristallnacht? 37th anniversary of Kristallnacht, 25 miles from here, in a building on First Avenue.
UN.
Zionism is racism. Is racism. Zionism is racism. Okay, the UN passes the resolution. Israel is in bad straits diplomatically. Okay, after the Yom Kippur War, they sever ties with many countries, and Israel has very few friends in international bodies. So, this is voted upon. Zionism equals racism. The response, of course, was by Daniel Patrick Moynihan and Chaim Herzog, who famously tears up the pieces of paper. Like his father, the chief rabbi tore up the white paper in 1939. But that's all well and good, as a nice show of Jewish pride. But what are the Jews going to do about it in Eretz Yisrael? What's the best response to Zionism is racism?
Build more.
Build more. Bingo. So the patriotic thing to do, to stick it to the Goyim, is settle Eretz Yisrael, including those parts of Eretz Yisrael that are extremely controversial, where there are heavy concentration of Arabs. So Gush Emunim, they're on fire. They want to build. They want to build. They have a meeting. By Tzvi Yehuda, yes, absolutely. So they have a meeting. Ariel Sharon is invited to this meeting. And he tells the people, if we don't build in the Shomron, the Jordanian artillery will be firing upon Tel Aviv before you know it. In other words, there's a security basis for settlement in the Shomron. Now, that's Sharon because he's a secularist. He's not using language of God and the Bible and all that sort of things. He's just security. We got to protect ourselves from Jordanian artillery. So he gave a fiery speech, wowing the crowd, and then in the memoirs of the leaders of the Gush Emunim, Sharon proceeded to enjoy the gastronomic portion of the evening. Those are the exact words. Okay, so Hanukkah is coming. Hanukkah was early that year, last week of November, first week of December 1975. And Rabin has a plan to counter Zionism as racism, and it's not settling Eretz Yisrael, no. It's a conference in Yerushalayim, a worldwide Jewish solidarity conference. So what's the last thing that an Israeli government wants to do during a conference on Jewish solidarity? Is to have Jew-on-Jew violence forcing Jews with the point of a gun off a spot of Eretz Yisrael. And the Gush Emunim knows that very point, that the government is going to be hard-pressed to do anything against us while this moment in time exists. So now's our chance. Let's settle and not leave, and the army won't force us off. So 2,000 people show up first night of December, Hanukkah. Then it rains the next night. The sleeping bags all get wet, but the people are having a good time. It's a real party. Then Shimon Peres shows up, the defense minister. Now, Peres was seen as their ally. Never officially, but behind the scenes, he was known as their ally. But he shows up and says, boys, you got to leave.
This is
an
Oprah?
This is at Sebastia. So he says, you got to go. You can't stay. The government didn't authorize this. You simply can't be here. You have to leave. So what happens? Who are the leaders? Hanan Porat and Rav Moshe Levinger. Now, Rav Moshe Levinger was of Chevron fame from the Park Hotel, 1968 Seder. So what does Levinger do? The meeting is held in a tent. You know, whenever you have like a defense minister show up in a campsite, they go into the tent for the meeting. So Levinger comes out of the tent, tears his shirt, kriya, Baruch Dayan Emes, and says, Eicha Yashva Badad. He starts reading Eicha. And the word goes out, Peres has turned against us. Tear kriya, it's a terrible thing. Eretz Yisrael is being lost. All right, so that didn't go well for Peres. Well, listen, even though he supports settlement, he doesn't want the government to have a crisis on its hands of a rampant illegality. They have to be able to control what goes on. And he's willing to authorize it after the fact, but he can't just say, do whatever you like. And the defense minister is in control of the territories. Remember, the territories are under military administration, so it's his bailiwick. So Peres leaves, and he's booed as the security guards usher him back to the chopper, and he leaves. Then, more negotiations. A few more days go by.
Did they leave?
No. So the army is hesitant to carry out an order of expulsion. The army commander who was supposed to carry out the order was himself a fairly right-wing Jew and brought his wife and children for Shabbos at the campsite in Sebastia. So the whole thing was very bizarre. Now let me try to give a bit of an explanation here. What was happening in the mid-1970s in Israel was that the state of Israel didn't exist. There was no state. There was Zionism. And there's a big difference between Zionism and the state of Israel. Zionism is the settling of Eretz Yisrael by Am Yisrael. And in the days of the Ottoman Empire, and in the days of the British Mandate, did Jews really care what the law was? No! We care to settle Eretz Yisrael, and we'll do whatever we can until we get caught, and then go to jail, and then break out of jail, and we settle again. Everything that needs to be done for Yishuv Eretz Yisrael will be done, irrespective of the law. The Dina de Malchus Adina doesn't apply when the Sultan or the High Commissioner is preventing Aliyah, preventing land purchases, and preventing Yishuv Eretz.
But it wasn't a Jewish thing.
Okay, all right. So, that's 1920, 1930, 1947, April 1948. But now, there's been a Jewish state for 27 years, and yet, it's like it doesn't exist at all. People are toting guns as though they have to shoot at somebody because the army is after us. It's a Jewish army. What's going on here? So really what was happening was that it wasn't only the right-wing religious Zionist lunatics who were in favor of settlement in Arab lands. It was even the left-wing labor types who were recalling their youth. Remember, the Palmachniks, Achdut Avodah, the Mapam, what did they think in 1945, 46, 47? Did they believe in the partition plan? No. They believed in all of Eretz Yisrael. Now, how they were going to achieve it, they never really had a clue. But they believed in all of Eretz Yisrael, and only the reality of 1948 to 1967 prevented that from happening. But now, Eretz Yisrael is in our grasp, and so, let's do it. So there was a youthful desire, a resurgence of enthusiasm by guys in their 50s and 60s who had been part of the pre-state era of the Palmach and the real hardcore labor settlers on the periphery of the country. They wanted to go back to the good old days.
But these were old-timers.
Granted, they're not the ones who are actually going to settle. The ones who are going to settle are guys with the knitted yarmulkes. But the people in political positions of power were VIPs, were recalling their childhood experiences and saying, you know what? It's like the good old days all over again.
Yeah, we did the same thing.
We did the same thing. So Yigal Alon, who is supposedly against all this, because it's against the Alon plan, he doesn't criticize Hanan Porat for having a wildcat settlement. After all, he taught him that from the days in the 30s and 40s. This is what we did in the days when the British were in control. He's angry with Perez that Perez, you the defense minister, should have put roadblocks to prevent these people from getting to Sebastia in the first place. So it's your fault. I'm not going to blame the settlers. They're patriotic Jews. I'll blame the defense minister for being incompetent or for being in cahoots all along. So that's what's going on here. You have people recalling the good old days and reliving them, except under a Jewish country with a Jewish army and a Jewish government. And the whole thing doesn't make any sense anymore. Yigal Alon complained that relations with the United States were suffering. And he said, you know, when we did labor settlement between 1967 and 1974, when we settled in the Jordan Valley, in the Jerusalem corridor, and maybe even on the Golan, we went to non-controversial places, we did it quietly and discreetly, and we didn't make a lot of hoopla. And the Americans didn't have a problem with it. It's only when you do it with a lot of fanfare in densely Arab-populated areas and in contravening government policy, where we have to then try to extract you, expel you, that's when the Americans got angry. What was Alon actually saying here? He was comparing the Americans to a half-sympathetic British mandatory power. Like when in the 30s, when the Jews would settle somewhere with the tower and stockade, but quietly in the night, the British would say, fine, what you did, it's on, it's yours. It's only when the Jews of the Yishuv tried to push the envelope and go places that the British really objected to that they cracked down. So here, he's the foreign minister of the State of Israel and pretending as though that whereas in the 1930s the bosses were the British mandate, in the 1970s the bosses are really the Americans. And we're just trying to act below the radar. So you see, what is there? There's no State of Israel. There are just Jews acting on their own as best they think they can get away with. Okay. Who doesn't like this?
Everybody.
So the law and order types. People who are not fond of settling in the territories, or who believe that settling in certain parts of the territories is a bad idea, and they want a state to have the government, the army, in control of the situation at all times. Yigal Yadin is such a person, and he announces, I'm running for prime minister. This cannot continue. Yitzhak Rabin doesn't have control of the country. People are going off to the territories and plopping themselves down and saying, I want to live here, and Rabin can't do anything about it. So Yadin announces, I'm going to run for prime minister. What party is he going to run with? There are two parties, Likud and Labor. Which one is he going to run with? Neither. He'll make his own party, the DMC, the Democratic Movement for Change, and next week we'll talk about that at length. But I'm trying to explain here that people were dissatisfied with the chaos, the lawlessness that was Israel in mid-70s, because Rabin wasn't in control. All right, so what happens at Sebastia? What was the end result? The government made a decision. We'll allow 30 families to stay on an army base near Shechem at Camp Kadum, providing the military with services. So these will be like government army contractors. So 30 families can live on the base with civilian jobs. And we'll figure out their permanent status in 2 or 3 months' time. We'll kick the can down the road. Okay, so Levinger and Porat, are they going to accept that? They'll be moved from Sebastia about a mile down the road to Camp Kadum. Are they going to accept that? So now we have to figure out what's in their better interests. They put their thinking caps on, they go into the tent, and they come out of the tent, and they announce, we won! And people put them on the shoulders, and there's a famous photograph of Levinger and Porat dancing, holding each other by the hands on the shoulders of somebody else. Okay, victory is ours! Simon Tov Mazel Tov, Yehi Lanu L'Chol Yisrael Amen. Why is it a victory? Because instead of 25 individuals, and remember, settlement is usually individuals, now it's 30 families. Family means what? That there's children, and there's going to be long-term, this will be a real deal. This is not just going to be a passing fad. People, real civilians, including children, will be able to settle themselves in this region. If not this here, 1 mile over. Okay, so 3 months later, what happens? Nothing. They kick the can down and run a little further. 5 months later, what happens? Oh, the government makes a decision. And the decision is, you can't stay at Camp Kadum, which is east of Nablus, but we'll give you a spot that's west of Nablus, which becomes Kadumim. And they say no. Now, Kadumim is established, but this group, the Elon Moreh group, says no. Now, why does the government say yes to Kadumim, but no to the Elon Moreh? Because the government now has a new theory. The Green Line is too far to the west. Israel is too narrow. The waist is too narrow. How many miles is it?
11,
12, 13, whatever they say. 9, it's really like, it depends where, but the shortest is about 11.
Natanya is 11.
Yeah, Natanya is about 11. So, and there it's maybe about 13 or 14, northern Shomron. So, the government says, you know what? We need to expand the waist. Israel's too narrow, Israel proper. And the aquifers are in the Sumerian foothills as you go up towards the mountains. So it's not so densely populated with Arabs. There's water there that Israel needs. And we need the security of expanding the waste. So let's take... Huh?
They have the hilltop.
Right. So let's take that region and forget about Nablus itself or east of Nablus, which is too densely populated with Arabs. So from an Israeli point of view, it does make a great degree of sense. From a centrist point of view, it makes a lot of sense. It also was a change from the Alon plan, because remember the Alon plan was the Green Line will remain the border. You do not expand the waste. What happens if you expand the waste and you take the Jordan Valley? What does that leave the Arabs with? Almost nothing. Very little. You know, Vedic territory. You know, they don't have much left. Now, from a maximalist point of view, from a Zionist maximalist point of view, that's great. You know, why give the Arabs anything? You know, but it's not going to work itself out if you want a peace treaty. So the government has this idea, and Porat and Levinger say, no, we're going to stay east of Nablus. What ends up happening? Elon Moreh is established is in 77, and then again they move a little bit, and they move to 1980. But in 1977, that iteration of Elon Moreh, who goes for the dedication ceremony? Who dedicates a Sefer Torah on May 19th, 1977? Menachem Begin, Prime Minister-elect of Israel, 2 days after the election, goes to Elon Moreh, holds the Sefer Torah under the chuppah, under the canopy, and says, there will be many more Elon Morehs when I'm Prime Minister of Israel. So he's gloating over what's going on. All right. along the way, as these negotiations were happening, there were people who were in the government who were dissatisfied with the way the government was capitulating to the settlers. And Rabin at one point said, after the first agreement in December of 75, if anyone in the government tries to sabotage this, I'll resign. Meaning, don't get in the way. We made a deal, let's stick to the deal. And he was very firm on this. He doesn't want the government to collapse over internal disputes. Let it be the Memshalah on the one hand and the settlers on the other, and we'll come to some sort of an arrangement, but don't have the government be divided.
The religious party was part of the government.
The NRP was part of the government, absolutely. And the NRP is very happy that the government is capitulating to the settlers, because the NRP at this point is a settler party. Although Yosef Berg is still the head of the party and is not a maximalist, he's from the old line, he sees the handwriting on the wall, and the younger, the Tzi'irim, the younger guard of the NRP, is really the one that's calling the shots in terms of party policy. Okay. So, was Sebastia the beginning of right-wing settlement in Israel, or was it the end of the beginning? Or the beginning of the end? It certainly wasn't the beginning of the end, but it was the end of the beginning. The truth is, the illegality and the ad hoc nature of settlement didn't begin in 1974 or 75. It begins right away in 1967. And anyone who wants to complain that Shimon Peres is at fault for allowing this and for allowing all sorts of chaos, as Yigal Alon wanted to complain, they can throw right back at Yigal Alon. You were just as complicit in different parts of the country at an earlier time. So the first one was the Maghreb Quarter. Okay, the Maghreb Quarter was destroyed a week after the Six-Day War. Why? To make the Kotel Plaza. Who allowed it? Nobody allowed it. It was just done. It was just done. And the government even denied participation. The army said, we didn't have a hand in it. Private citizen contractors, civilian contractors. Of course he authorized it. But it was very easy for people in position of power to say, well, it just happened. Fog of war, fog of war.
They got a phone call from the president next morning.
Yeah.
Telling them to stop.
Oh, well. It didn't happen. So that's the first thing. Then you have Gush Etzion, which begins almost immediately after the Six-Day War, that people, survivors of the original Gush, which meant Kfar Etzion, Masorot Yitzchak, Ein Surim and Revadim, all got together and said, we should rebuild what we once had. So those were three religious kibbutzim and one Mapam secularist. Revadim was secular. And they went back and they decided to rebuild. And so you have Alon Shvut and the like. And that's between 67 and about 1970. Then you have in the Golan, Merom HaGolan and Keshet in 1974. Then you have Baal Chatzor, which becomes Ofra. And then you have Sebastia, which becomes Elon Moreh. So there were several, and I forgot Chevron, and Chevron in 1968. And Alon was the patron saint of the folks in Chevron, which led to the creation of Kiryat Arba. So Sebastia was not the first example, it was about the fifth or sixth example of beginning something without approval, but then gaining retroactive approval. But yeah.
You make me now understand better how I became, my family became a pawn in this. You did not mention the southern part, the core specifically.
I
remember distinctly in 1986 seeing Bobby Brown at of the Jewish Agency. He gave me his keys to his villa there, and we spent 6 weeks thinking that perhaps we would settle. Geula Cohen heard about us.
Yeah.
And came with her TV cameras to record interviews. And little did I know about the Gush Emunim. She was, of course, a leader in that. Every morning it was depopulated. The core would be depopulated.
Sure.
We would stay there to do the necessary work. And the Arabs, we would be awakened every morning with the call to prayer.
Call to prayer,
The only saving grace was seeing the Merkava
tanks
at exercises, and the Phantom above us, and the Herodian nearby.
Tekoa is an out-of-the-way place. It really certainly was then.
My family, many members in Israel, that we are in Israel. He said, where are you, Asher? I'm in Tekoa. When are you coming to Israel?
Okay, so now let's examine how the Rabin government collapses in the 10 minutes that we have left, because next time I want to get to the election. Rabin, in late 1976, believed that despite the chaos in the territories and despite the continued high inflation, which went down a little bit but was still pretty high, I think about 38% in 1976, which is pretty high, and despite other economic problems, that the raid on Entebbe, Operation Thunderbolt, and the successful resupply of the IDF with American weapons and the restored good relations with the United States would put him over the top to win re-election. He was confident that that could happen. But election is not scheduled for another year, late in 1977. It's now late 1976. But he has an opportunity to call for early elections because of a crisis that develops. On December 10th, 1976, there was a ceremony for the F-15s that came from America. And the ceremony was on a Friday, and it involved an aerial flyover with this and that, loops and around, fancy flying acrobatics. And the ceremony ended 20 minutes before Shabbos. And it was in an out-of-the-way place in the south. So government ministers who were there had to be guilty of Chilul Shabbos to get home Friday night. So the Aguda, which was not involved politically much in the 1970s, they were out of the government, they were opposition members, they called for no confidence. And the NRP abstained in the vote, despite the fact that the NRP were members of the government. Now, why did the NRP abstain? Because, on the one hand, they can't vote against the government since they're part of it. On the other hand, they can't be seen as insufficiently frum, because Shabbos, you know? So they abstain. But that was enough for Rabin to fire them. He fires them. Then he resigns, and the resignation of the prime minister means the resignation of the whole cabinet, and calls for early elections for May of 1977, 6 months earlier than scheduled. He thinks he has a good chance of winning. After all, Labor has never lost, so it would be a big thing if the Likud actually won, but he thinks that his candidacy is a pretty impressive candidacy. But things go south for him very quickly.
Was this set up by Rabin?
Huh?
Was this a setup?
No, it was. I believe this was completely innocent. This was not a setup. No.
The F-15s, didn't they come late because of bad weather?
I believe they left from Malta late or something like that.
It was weather
related. It was not because of an Israeli shenanigans. It was just the Americans couldn't get the planes there soon enough.
So isn't there a heifer for that? I mean, the ministers could have stayed in the Air Force Base over Shabbos. What kind of...
All right, the Aguda wanted no confidence. What can I tell you? So, bad things now happen for the Labor Party. First thing is, the housing minister, Avraham Ofer, is accused of corruption, and he commits suicide. He claimed, in a suicide note, he protested his innocence, and it really tore Rabin to pieces that it was a friend of his committed suicide. No, it was just he denied the accusation, and he killed himself. Then Rabin had appointed Asher Yadlin to be the head of the Bank of Israel. And Yadlin was arrested and convicted and sentenced to 5 years in jail for corruption. So what do you see here? The Labor Party was a party of patronage that had lost its ideological bent. It was no longer the socialist party of the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. It was really just a catch-all party for people who wanted to wield power or to have government jobs. And they did not have a coherent policy when it came to the territories. There were doves, there were hawks, there were capitalists, there were socialists. There was everybody in the Labor Party, and it didn't really stand for anything in particular. So it had been in power way too long, and those who took advantage of their position for illegal gain were getting caught, because Rabin's policy now was not to suppress bad news, but rather, if someone is accused of wrongdoing, to prosecute the offender and to not cover up scandal. But that policy of not covering up scandal came to bite him personally. So what happened? So Rabin got a phone call on March 15th while he was in New York. He was in New York after his visit to Carter in Washington, and the call was from a reporter from Haaretz, asking about bank accounts that he had, that Rabin had had when he was ambassador to the United States. And Rabin didn't know much about it because he left all the finances and the personal domestic issues to Leah. He wasn't interested in these things. Let Leah take care of everything. And Leah did. But Leah didn't close down her two accounts, checking and savings. And it was illegal for Israelis to hold foreign bank accounts unless you had... So they, at the high point, there was $20,000, but it was whittled down slowly over time so that by 1977, there was only $2,000 left. She had been making withdrawals every time she went to the United States, and she would take some money home. So and this was not ill-gotten money. This was legitimately their money. There was no there was nothing nefarious about it. It's just that it was a crime officially to have a foreign bank account.
Once he was no longer ambassador.
Once he was no longer ambassador, what he should have done was close it promptly and report the returned money back to the Israeli treasury. He could keep the money, but he had to report it to the treasury. So they didn't do that. And
they didn't pay taxes on it.
I'm not sure what the tax liability was, but they certainly didn't pay. They would pay a fine afterwards after getting caught, which would be $27,000. So yeah, so the papers report this middle of March, and it's not a big news story. The Jerusalem Post runs an op-ed saying, "Well, Rabin should have been more careful about things. It was Leah's fault." They made a little faux pas. Let them pay a penalty, whatever the penalty might be. That's going to be assessed by the treasury, and we'll move on with life. A little slap on the wrist, a little censure, and let's get on with the election. So nobody was calling for him to resign. But then, in April, there is a committee under Attorney General Aharon Barak, who is either beloved or reviled by people around the Jewish world for his years as Supreme Court chief in Israel. So the committee recommendation was only for a little penalty, a slap on the wrist. And Barak rejected his own committee's report. As the attorney general, as the chief prosecutor, he said, no, Leah Rabin will go to trial. And it could carry a jail sentence. A jail sentence. So on April 7th, it was a major day in the history of Medinat Israel. What happened on April 7th, 1977? Anachnu al hamapa. We're on the map. So good. Tal Brody said we're on the map. Maccabi Tel Aviv won the EuroLeague championship. Okay, this was a great day in Israeli history, only tied by when Gal Friedman won for windsurfing in 2004. Okay, all right, so Maccabi Tel Aviv wins. Everybody's fireworks going off. It's like when the Yankees win the World Series in Washington Heights. You know, all the fireworks go off. Everybody's all happy. Then, 11 o'clock at night, Rabin gets on the TV and says, "I'm sorry to announce I'm resigning," like a very gruff voice. So why is he resigning? Because the prosecutor's office said Leah has to go to trial. And he's going to stand with his woman and not throw her under the bus. So, good. She goes to trial, and the conclusion is guilty, and you have a choice. Either a year in jail, or $27,000 fine. 156,000 shekels, or something like that. So she paid the fine. I don't even know where they got the money from, because I don't think he had that much money. They had to borrow it. So with this resignation, who's the Prime Minister of Israel? Okay, so now we get to a very complicated issue here. Rabin resigned in December of 76. The halacha in Israel is that when you resign as prime minister, automatically there's a caretaker government. And a caretaker government must remain in place until after the new elections and a new cabinet is formed by a successor prime minister. So that could take months, and it would because the election was for 6 months later. So he could not resign as prime minister. It was illegal for him to resign. He could not resign as prime minister because he already had resigned as prime minister, now he's a caretaker prime minister. So he couldn't do that. Then he said, let me try to resign as Knesset member. He couldn't do that because the rule is that the prime minister must be a Knesset member. So he's stuck. The only way out was, there's a caveat in the law, you could claim inability to perform public office. But that was intended for people who are in a coma or medical incapacity. For him to say he couldn't hold his public office would mean that he was so overwhelmed by this scandal that he was, couldn't function. And he was not willing to do that because it wasn't really true. He was able to function. So on April 7th, he announces a further resignation, which has no legal standing, and he goes on vacation with Leah to Sharm el-Sheikh. And what does he say? That Peres is the acting prime minister. But really, it's of no legal validity, this notion of acting prime minister. The only time there had ever been previously an acting prime minister was when Eshkol died. If you remember, who was acting prime minister when Eshkol died? Yigal Alon, for 3 weeks, was acting prime minister until Golda took over. So Peres runs the government in an informal capacity from April 7th until Begin takes over, I believe, on June 20th or thereabouts. Okay, so about 2.5 months, Peres is nominally the prime minister, but not really. Okay, so in the 2 minutes we have left, or we're going to go overboard, if not for this scandal, who was supposed to run for prime minister for the Labour Party?
Rabin.
Did anyone challenge him? Yes. Shimon Peres challenged him. And this was a big disgrace, because no sitting prime minister of Israel had ever been challenged in an intra-party primary before. It's a chutzpah to run against your own party member for the premiership. And yet in February of 77, that's exactly what happened. Now remember, in 1974, the two of them went head-to-head to see who would succeed for Golda. And in that election, Rabin won about 298 to 254, something thereabouts, about 40-vote difference. This time, the party central committee had been expanded, and there were about 2,800 voters. And the final tally was 1,445 to 1,404. Rabin won by 41 votes out of 2,800. So the party was split. The party was split big time. And Peres almost won, but he didn't win. So he would not have been the candidate if not for these scandals. Going forward, with Rabin no longer the prime minister, and with the party losing the election, as we'll see next week, the question is, who's really in control of the Labour Party? And they made a deal. They made a 70-30 split. 70% of the party patronage would go to the Peres camp, and 30% would go to the Rabin camp. But it's all about the patronage. It's all about percentages. Nothing was about ideology. So that was the fate of Labour after 29 years as the leaders of Medinat Yisrael, after 44 years as in control of the Yishuv, Labour will be the losers. So we'll stop here.